Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Pierce Bauer.
Hey, what's up?
It's just me and Pierce here tonight to discuss David Fincher's latest release, Mank, which was released briefly in theaters and is now on Netflix. We're also primarily going to talk about a career-spanning view of David Fincher, and more narrowly, we're going to rank all of his 11 movies. And we're just going to get right into it. Mank is the story of, what's his first name? Henry? Is that right? Just calls him Mank in the movie.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just calling him Mank will suffice.
Sure. Mankiewicz, who was like a staff writer for major studios, MGM in this case, in the 30s. He's a bit of a drunk. He's got a wife and kids who he doesn't really see and lives across the country from. After a fallow career period in the late 30s, he gets tasked to write Citizen Kane for Orson Welles, and he does so hidden away in a Victorville hothouse with a broken leg. Black and white, very old-timey. The credits sync up with what you would expect from seeing like really anything from the 1930s. Not that I have a huge amount of experience in that time period as a movie watcher. Pierce, what'd you think of Mank?
Mank, the story of Herman Mankiewicz.
There it is.
Did a little research there.
We come prepared.
You know, ultimately I liked it. As we'll talk about in the rest of the podcast, I'm a big Fincher file. You know, I am interested in anything he does. So I guess to prelude this review real quick, like I did question going into the movie how much of my interest or enjoyment or whatever would come from the movie itself versus the dialogue around the movie and just that exploration that comes with a new Fincher movie. So separating it from that, I think it's perfectly good. It didn't blow me away the way some of his other movies are, to me, very encapsulating. I think this one, the interest for me comes from its kind of pseudo-dialogue with Citizen Kane, which I watched in preparation, or rewatched in preparation. The actual echoing of the themes of Citizen Kane and the origins of it, those interest me in this movie. Everything else about it, I found a bit tiresome, you know? But I'm curious what you thought, John, because I know you told me recently you've actually never even seen Citizen Kane, which I found fascinating. So I'm really curious. For me, my sole enjoyment really came from this as a piece of art in response to Kane. So I'm curious what you thought as someone who hasn't seen it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen all of The Simpsons from the 90s, so I feel like I've seen like 40% of Citizen Kane, just in bits and pieces and parodies here and there. But, and I also, you know, I mean, I live in the world. I have a general sense of Citizen Kane. I just haven't watched it because it is a very important movie. And I mean, it's a very important movie because it was ahead of its time and because it was especially after watching Mank, it was like directly political at a period of time when movies aren't really like that, speaking truth to power and such. I feel like I get the gist without having seen it, and I definitely wasn't lost while watching Mank. This is probably the most anti-commercial movie that David Fincher's ever made, possibly suitable for like a Netflix release where it doesn't really matter. If these were regular times and this was going to play in theaters for like 2 or 3 months, I can't imagine this movie making any more than like $10 or $15 million. And Fincher is a guy who hasn't made a lot of movies. With one or two exceptions, they've all been, if not very successful, then successful. Like at a minimum, made their budget back, and some of them have been gigantic hits. So in Mank, I don't necessarily see it as the specific commentary on Citizen Kane. I see it as more of like a Steven Soderbergh type rant about where the movies are right now in the art form in general and art versus commerce. And I don't think of Fincher as somebody like that for the reason I just stated. Like, he's been successful and it seems like he's been able to get the power. He's been able to get the power and the money to make essentially whatever he's wanted. And the exception for that has been in this 6-year period between Gone Girl and Mank. And maybe in that time, he's just become super idealistic and or cynical in the way that he's seen how difficult it is to actually get a movie made. So I enjoy that meta level of it. I think the average moviegoer is maybe further away from that interpretation than they are from, like, I've seen Citizen Kane. I think the average moviegoer that is going to go see Mank has probably seen Citizen Kane and maybe isn't, like, plugged into what these major directors think about the state of the industry. So maybe the average moviegoer who's seen Citizen Kane can, like, plug into the story on that level. Mm-hmm. And that's the level that I think the movie is meeting audience at.
I get what you're saying.
I was going to back off from that statement, but yes, I do think that is true. I think Mank assumes that you've seen Citizen Kane, and I think that the movie, at its worst, is throwing out a lot of little sops to people that perhaps haven't and aren't able to, like, soak up all the cultural data that Citizen Kane has put out in the world. Like, there's a lot of clunkers in this movie, like clunker lines and characters having conversations that they wouldn't have with each other because they know all the details already. Like, it's not, the conversation isn't between them, it's between the movie and the audience. I was also really surprised at how idealistic it is. Probably the centerpiece scene is a very long monologue where a very drunk Mank, played by Gary Oldman, essentially runs down the entire plot of Citizen Kane directly to its inspiration, William Randolph Hearst, played by Charles Dance, a.k.a. Tywin Lannister, and what I thought was a pretty strong casting choice. And that speech is, I don't think of Fincher as an idealist either. I think of him as a very cynical person. I think of him as the guy who made Seven.
So you don't, I see, I think my takeaway from the movie as a whole is, I would not categorize it as a love letter to old Hollywood, the way I think a lot of other filmmakers maybe would. But is that what you're talking about with, like, the cynicism?
I mean, like, the actual history is that Mank wrote this screenplay and didn't write anything ever again. A formerly cynical guy who takes a turn towards idealism and has a future resulting from that idealism squashed, and therefore maybe the entire picture is cynical.
Yeah. But
there aren't idealists in Fincher movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he's bad at it. I don't think he's, like, distant or he can't connect with that kind of with that kind of optimism. But there's just consistently great dialogue in his movies, and he really sells a lot of the arguments and a lot of the passion behind those arguments. There is just some kind of dissonance in knowing that you're watching a Fincher film and seeing someone, like, really say, this is how it should be, this is just flat out wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And what is wrong, what Mank views as wrong in the movie, is that MGM is making political ads with actors in them posing as, like, real people. And this is, you know, in the 30s, and Mank is drawing it, and the movie and the character is drawing, like, a direct comparison to Leni Riefenstahl in Nazi Germany. And, you know, it's not an unfair comparison. There's a lot of that in the movie. What I do know about Fincher is that, you know, he's not, like, a Christopher Nolan level proponent of the cinematic experience, but I kind of think of him in that vein.
Well,
it's certainly a full-throated homage, paean defense of the theater-going experience, and what, like, a holy sacrament almost it is, which, you know, I'm always down for, because I somewhat agree with it, if not wholeheartedly agree with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, you said a lot there. So
I did.
I think, so what you're touching on there at the end, about Fincher's allegiances to whatever you want to call it, this type of Hollywood, right? Like, or this type of cinematic experience. The way I read his, the way he injects himself into this movie, why is Fincher making this movie, is more about ideas about creative control, because that's what I think of when I think of Fincher, right? And it goes back to Alien 3, which is like this genesis for him as a filmmaker, in which he loses all creative control to a studio system. And then kind of everything artistically he's done since is this kind of rejection of that, or in defiance of that. So the Mank character in that scene you're referencing, and then again, like, to kind of bring this back to the whole, like, Citizen Kane and then in succession, Mank, like, both are these anti-establishment films, and they take on the establishment in the sense of this intersection, which is what I think is great about Citizen Kane beyond just being an influential film. And I think what Mank comments on very well, which is what I liked about the movie, is this intersection of commerce, art, and politics. And in Kane, that comes in a lot of ways with, there is like a similar political campaign that's run within the movie that echoes, you know, what you were just describing that Hearst goes through and did in real life. And so all of these ideas that the movie's playing with in this kind of echo chamber with Kane and the 1930s, and then throw in what we're going through in 2020, that's what I found interesting in the movie. And when it comes to Fincher's place in telling that story, I think he comes from that perspective of, as a filmmaker who is so, you know, driven to tell or to make the movie his way, it is about this idea of creative control in many different ways. And so for me, I understood that within this movie. And that's the type of thing where, you know, when I say, like, I'm sure you can watch this movie without seeing Citizen Kane. Like, I understand that part. But and when I say that I think it benefits from it, I don't mean the type of thing where, like yes, Amanda Seyfried's character in Mank is very much playing a role that is then meant to be embodied within Kane as with a different character. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see that that one-to-one comparison is meant to be seen. But for me, when I say that, like, the dialogue it has with Citizen Kane is more about the themes that come with Kane. And those, I would also pitch to anybody, are like, you know, Citizen Kane, as stuffy as it can be because of when it was made, and also, like, it, you know, that thing of it feels like homework or whatever, there is a really compelling anti-establishment, like, very modern kind of character and story within it. And so for me, like, that is my draw within this movie. And I think, again, like, within Fincher's perspective, that's what makes sense to me. You know, that's my reading in some ways.
Yeah. And for me, it was this elevation of the theatrical experience. Part of what puts me off of Citizen Kane is just the compulsion I have to write about every movie that I watch. And the idea that I would write something about Citizen Kane is silly. Like, there isn't just anything, there's something else to be said about that. It's right. Not any more silly than me writing about, like, a movie that's got like 20 reviews on Letterboxd, which I, you know, I occasionally do because Roger Ebert, you know, gave it a solid review. Or RogerEbert.com gave it a solid review in 2018, in like the dead months of the cinematic year. But Mulholland Drive was the same way. When that made its way through my hopper, I would have, you know, I might have felt compelled to write like 3 pages on that, but instead I just wrote like a paragraph that there isn't really anybody who understands that movies are magic tricks better than David Lynch, because the best scene for me in Mulholland Drive is at the nightclub, where the MC tells the audience what's happening, the characters react to it, as surely as the audience is reacting to it, because what's happening on stage is incredibly beautiful, and then the movie reminds you of what you knew 3 minutes previously in the most blatant way possible, but it doesn't detract from the scene itself. Just the ability of movies to completely snow you and fool you and tell you exactly what they're doing and everything's above board, and just the ability to do that is what makes it such a powerful medium. And the way that Mank pitches that as what I said earlier, like holy and pure and in need of respect, just really resonates, especially at this time when it's, you know, it's like a moral choice to go see a movie in a theater now. And you contrast that with the character of Louis B. Mayer. He's not only producing these like fake propaganda ads, but he's also like convincing his entire studio to take pay cuts based on the delivery of a well-rehearsed monologue that he is himself acting. It's just in that scenario, there isn't any bargain that's been agreed upon between the people that he's cutting the pay of and him. It's only him that knows this is a show, and everybody else in the audience thinks that they're having a conversation with their boss. And just the obviously people have varying levels of charisma and are good and bad at convincing people of doing things. But for that speech to exist in the same movie, and for another example of that breakdown between what is real and what is fake, for it to be about not electing a lefty governor, and for it also to be about cutting wages while the studio head himself is surely not taking a pay cut. It's the movie really wearing its bright red politics on its sleeve, which I just really appreciate. Like it's like a little bit of Sorkin rubbed off on Fincher when they made The Social Network together. And Fincher's just superior to Sorkin in every way. So he didn't like bash you over the head with all of Sorkin's bullshit. So like as like a political document, that was my greatest hook. Like for the first like 20 minutes of Mank, I'm like, is this going to be one of those movies about making movies that is okay, but is just very narrow and really just for the industry? And it was when Louis B. Mayer first showed up that I realized that it was going to be a little bit more than that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's right. I think my, you know, compared to other Fincher films, my hesitance while watching this one came from, I think, a kind of failure to find its footing early on. And it isn't until Mank becomes intertwined with Hearst and that crowd of people. You know, there's a, like, at some, I don't know, the movies to me felt very long and kind of very, almost tiresome at times. But when it found its footing for me was when, I think it's a party scene in which they are just outright discussing politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But again, like you're saying, you know, it doesn't hit you over the head with it in the Sorkin way, where it is a filmmaker trying to impose his views on you, which is, I think, ultimately really what Sorkin's doing most of the time. But more so that it is showing you how the, I don't know, political climate of this time in this movie affected and influenced, you know, these series of events, but also this individual, right? Like, you know, one of the things that Mank does very well, I think, is... it's the point of the movie to an extent, and maybe it's a bit obvious, but it's this tracing of a man's life and the way he kind of regurgitates it through the movie, right? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you could just say tracing of a man's life and regurgitating it to his screenplay. And then, as you're a viewer of this film, you too are then doing, you know, you're witnessing the same thing, which is the regurgitation of a series of events that existed in history, right? And so, like, the way that it operates within the space politically or historically even, right, with, like, film history and all that shit, like, I enjoy that part of the movie. That's what works for me. So, I get what you're saying.
Well, yeah, we'll get to where it is in our rankings and in our more specific thoughts of it, grade-wise, I suppose, once we get to our rankings. But... It is still pretty fresh. I haven't like soaked up a lot of like critical talk about it. Not really. But yeah, my initial thought was like, this is very much an outlier for Fincher. Doesn't mean it's necessarily bad, but I do think he's a little on his back foot.
It felt like one for him, which is
absolutely, yes, absolutely. Right. More than anything he's ever done, one for him.
Yes. And for a filmmaker like Fincher, you'd think, based on, you know, how, I don't know, consistently, like, you know, his, we'll talk about it within, as we go through his filmography, but, like, he clearly has a subject matter that draws his eye, you know? And usually that involves some type of grotesque crime or killing or, you know, something in that realm. And for something like Mank to not, you know, if you asked me what would be Fincher's passion project, I would never have guessed this, you know. But that goes for a lot of filmmakers, probably. Like, you know, if you asked me what was Scorsese's passion project, I wouldn't have guessed Silence, you know. Mm-hmm. So getting to see this from him, I think, is fascinating. And again, it goes back to maybe where I started with a lot of this, which was, my interest in the movie goes beyond just the movie. I'm more interested in deciphering this as, you know, Fincher's relationship to this. And you know, there is an interesting story behind that, which is that his father wrote the screenplay. So there's an added layer even. So, like, all of that extra discourse that just gets thrown on top is what I would say at this point is what I'm more interested in than revisiting the movie itself
necessarily. Yeah. Like, there's not going to be an unspooled episode about this. The podcast that formerly went through like the AFI Top 100 and now is going through. They're just doing something different. But it's like 2-hour podcast dedicated to really dissecting a single movie. Like, if they were going to do this movie, the conversation would be extremely interesting. Just as far as all these little tidbits and connections to Citizen Kane, as well as to Fincher himself, and his father writing the screenplay, and Fincher producing it and directing it long after he's been dead. Sure, I have no doubt that there is a level of fine detail in this, just because the guy's made all these movies and we kind of know what his game is by now. Yeah, a lot of it did go over my head in that first viewing. And I don't think I'd like it enough to ever. I mean, it is on Netflix now, and you can just, you know, throw it on anytime you like. But I don't know that that'll be happening anytime in the future. And I think with that, we'll graduate into our rankings of the films of David Fincher and how we're going to do this. Pierce is going to go first, and then me. We're going to start at 11 and go up to 1. And we're not going to talk about a movie until we both said it. So, Pierce, why don't you tell us what your number 11 Fincher movie is?
So, as we were talking before the podcast, John, I thought we would probably sync up fairly reasonably at the bottom of our lists. But honestly, after speaking with you just for a couple minutes about it, and we didn't really spoil anything on our lists, I have no idea where you're going to rank this movie. I think it's the obvious bottom, and it's Alien 3. Mainly because it's the least of his actual movies that he had a hand in, I think. So it's just like, how do you place it above something that was actually had a vision to it? But that's my absolute bottom is Alien 3.
My absolute bottom is The Game.
Okay.
Pierce, number 10.
So number 10, I have Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
All right. My number 10 is Alien 3. This is not my least favorite of his movies, because I love the Xenomorph so much. It's maybe my favorite, like, creature creation in all of movies. You can only screw up a movie with the Xenomorph in it so much. Like, even Alien versus Predator Requiem it's bad. Make no mistake. But it's not the worst movie in the world by any means. It's got the Xenomorph in it. Does the Xenomorph have, like, 3 predator heads and barf babies down pregnant women's? Here nor there. We're talking about Alien 3 here. Yes, this isn't his movie, but you just have to admire the balls on a movie that, like, kills 2 out of the 3 survivors in the opening credits from the previous beloved movie. I just think that's pretty incredible that this movie did that. It's got some of the best, at least one of the best shots in the whole franchise, with the alien, like, drooling on a bald Sigourney, a bald and terrified and surrendering Sigourney Weaver. It's the worst of those first 4. I don't see how you can make an argument otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's still a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think I almost take a, like an opposite stance from where you're at, which is that or at least from where we meet in the middle, which is that like I also love Alien and Aliens. Like those are two top 25 movies for me easily. I don't even want to touch the imperfections. Like I just want those two movies, and I some of the newer ones are fine, but I'm more of a give me those two, and then I'm just gonna not even watch these other ones because I know I don't enjoy them, and they only harm my rose-tinted view of the original. Yeah.
If I had a stronger relationship to Aliens, which I rank as third out of those first four,
wow,
then you know I might be a little more upset about poor Newt and poor what's his face, just fucking biting it as soon as that movie starts. I think that's just great. I love that. Pierce, what's your number 9?
So my number 9 is The Game.
Tell me about The Game.
Well, I recently did a full watch of Fincher's films, and this was the first time I'd ever seen The Game was this year. I think it's a cool idea with like some interesting choices. You know, it's something I would say about Fincher that you could say about a couple of these movies is like, I think if you had seen some of his more popular ones and then you put a bunch of movies in like a police lineup, you could easily pick out the Fincher film just how it looks, you know? And The Game does that in an interesting way. Like, I like the way this movie looks. I like the tone he gives it, things like that. The story itself, though, is just, like, kind of cheesy. Like, cheesy is maybe too simple a word for it, but, like, that ending is just so convoluted or, I don't know, underbaked or something. I don't know what it is, but that ending is just too much and then leaves the movie with just a nothing feeling. But I think it's that type of thing. The way I think about The Game is also is, like, I think for the average Fincher fan, who maybe hasn't seen this, but they've seen like, you know, your Sevens, your Fight Clubs. I think if you describe the plot of this movie and then told them that guy made this movie, it seems like a no-brainer. So it's got its flaws, but I think there's something interesting about it, at least. It's a good maybe one-time watch.
Yeah, I think that's fair to be a completionist, but I think this movie's bad. Mm-hmm. I think the story is garbage. I think it's truly terrible. I think there's no rooting interest, and I think the story itself is just ridiculous. It's just absurd and ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Full stop.
It's got a very like this is like a short story you'd read in a literature class, like that would have like a very clear moral to the ending. You know, yeah. Like it's something like that. And like I said, like I think there's cool moments where his directing shines. But you can get that fix from better movies if you so please, you know?
Yeah. I think in terms of his direction here, I mean, yes, great. But I wouldn't make a distinction between watching The Game and watching one of his music videos in that respect. I just think the story is so, so dumb.
It's very 90s. Like the whole vibe of this movie is so, you know, if this movie wasn't made by Fincher, it would have been like such a weird kind of, you know, back of the blockbuster movie that you're just like, oh, Michael Douglas wasn't that, you know, like,
yeah.
It's like a one that would have no lasting power if it wasn't for the Fincher tag on it.
Alien 3 is I haven't seen that in a long time. There might be something there, maybe. But I think The Game is just empty and about nothing. And I think what it thinks it's about is just so surface level that it may as well be about nothing.
Mm-hmm. You get some really fun Sean Penn overacting.
Yeah.
That's my one big sell for the movie.
My number 9 is Panic Room.
Okay.
What's your number 8?
My number 8 is a movie I think you'll probably have higher than me. Is Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Okay. My number 8 is Benjamin Button. I think it's nice and fine. We're out of the... We'll talk about Panic Room when it comes up. I don't really have strong feelings about Panic Room. Past this point, I like all of these movies, if not love them. I think Benjamin Button is a little corny, but it's more affecting than I thought it was going to be way back in 2008 when I saw this. I was kind of leaning towards this is going to be a corny lifestyle Forrest Gump-esque biopic. of a fake person, but it did really work on me. That's not to say that it isn't occasionally corny, but I think there's a lot of great like small supporting roles played by great actors in it, and it's pretty revolutionary as far as the CGI technology, which I don't know, maybe it doesn't hold up now after we've been doing this for like more than a decade with like the face replacement. But I remember it being pretty seamless at the time.
I would say, because I had this at 10, so I would say I think it is very corny. And I would say I don't think the CGI is bad necessarily. I think that an old man baby is just fucking creepy. And like maybe that's a little too simple, but it's the moment in the film when he becomes old man baby, I'm out. I am so out. I just think it's dull. Like you said, like it's not, it's perfectly fine. I think that's really what it is like this movie's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
I find it dull. I think it's long. And I think it, like I said, like it's just a corny kind of concept to me. And even with something like The Game, which I have ranked one spot higher, like, I don't know, if you asked me to think about one of these movies for a prolonged amount of time, I would choose to want to think about The Game versus Benjamin Button. It really comes down to that. I don't think it's a bad movie. I just think his other movies are far more interesting.
Yeah, totally fair. You're number 7.
So at 7, I have Mank.
Okay.
Is really there just for, you know, recency reasons.
My number 7 is Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
Okay.
I think this movie, when did this come out? This came out in 2010. I associate this movie with Skyfall in the same way that it was going to be ranked a whole lot higher. It was going to be like well into the A range until the last little bit of the movie with Skyfall. It's like the Home Alone Scottish Manor bullshit that completely turned me around on that movie. And here it's the idea that Lisbeth Salander would be like attracted to the character of Daniel Craig. And when he's just this deeply, I would say deeply average TV reporter or journalist or whatever.
Yeah.
And she is like this almost iconic, like hacker chick who is just so much more interesting than him. And that the movie, like the final shot of the movie is him seeing, or is her seeing him with some other woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then she like fading off into the snow. Who gives a shit?
Mm-hmm.
This movie is about like a multi-generational serial killer / rapist. Truly, who gives a fuck about this boring romance? That being said, everything up to those like final 5 or 10 minutes, I think, is really fantastic in Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
It's tough to think about this movie without the context of when it entered my consciousness and then rewatching it this year. Because when it entered my consciousness, I was a bit too young to really understand it. Like, it was very, you know, I still don't get the phenomenon around those books.
Neither do I. Yeah.
And especially after rewatching the movie. Maybe it was just at the precipice of this obsession we now have with this type of crime story as popular culture, maybe. I don't know. But, like, watching it again, it was so popular. At a time in my life where I didn't read those books because I was young and I wasn't going to. And I saw the movie and really was, I think the big takeaway was kind of the scandal, not like scandal in a bad way, but the scandalous rape scenes. Like, and so it was like watching it now, this movie confuses me. And I don't know if that's my fault or not, but like you were saying, I don't think this movie understands the Rooney Mara character at all. You're saying that relationship that springs out of nothing is a just glaring red mark on this movie. Like, it's so bizarre to watch what that character goes through in the first half to then just have her hop in bed with Daniel Craig is a just strange choice.
Oh yeah, I forgot they hook up.
They do very, very effortlessly, like very, there's no romantic,
which I guess would be fitting for her character because this is purely physical.
That just feels like a remnant of a novel that is from that type of genre. That it seems like the Stieg Larsson novel kind of bridges this gap of kind of gritty crime and like very like real, you know, rape and brutality, but then also is kind of this sexy mystery thriller. And it's trying to bridge that gap, and it just does not work in the movie for me. When I was watching it again, like, parts of this movie are just, like, are fine. Like, parts of this movie are just, like, pretty similar to the other things I've said about these movies. Like, this is the tier for me that just doesn't work, but it's Fincher, you know? So there's something to it. And so there's scenes like that. But there's also large chunks of this movie that are Daniel Craig interviewing Scandinavian-looking people, and I have no idea who anybody is or who they are talking about. And then it all culminates in the end. It doesn't fit for me. Like, it's just, it's a weird reveal, and it's a very sharp turn it takes from, you know, a modest investigation of a missing girl to a strung up Daniel Craig in a rape dungeon with like automatic gas chambering. Like, it's a very just, I don't know. It makes sense for Fincher. I get why he got tapped to make this. And again, it's one of those things where it's all the better because he's involved. If not, I think they made a sequel to this without him, and it's quite bad from what I read. But sure. It's just, this movie just does not work for me. And I can't, frankly, I can't say I understand the choices even.
My rankings might very well be different if I did rewatch these movies and you are convincing me. I mean, come on, who would rewatch this movie that marketed itself as the feel-bad movie of the Christmas season? But yeah, I think its success is split pretty evenly between Mara, who is really going for it, and Fincher, who he's not the first person to take a crack at this series. He wouldn't be the last person. Like, there's a Swedish version of the entire trilogy, and my understanding of those movies is that they're also fine. And my understanding as far as Stieg Larsson himself is that he wrote the Daniel Craig character as an audience, as a surrogate. Like, he's him. And, he's like a smart, attractive guy who women want to sleep with. And, you know, of course, that's always a little gross when writers put themselves. I think there's a term for that. Is that Mary Sue? Is that what that is?
Based on what I know of Mary Sue, I don't think so. Mary Sue is a female character who effortlessly overcomes everything.
Yeah, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's a term for like when a male writer writes himself as
exactly as
the cool, the male equivalent.
If we could give it a name, it should be the Sorkin, I think, because that's kind of what he does.
That sounds good. Pierce, you're number six.
So at six, I have Panic Room.
Okay.
I would say this is where Mank dependent, like I said, Mank's kind of in the middle for now, just because this is where it takes a leap for me. This is the next tier. I think Panic Room is just like, if I could think of like a sports analogy, it's kind of just like getting to watch like Shaquille O'Neal dunk a basketball. Like, it's just like getting to watch a guy do what he's made to do. And I think that's what Fincher's doing with Panic Room. It's like, the movie is called Panic Room. In the first minute, you see the panic room. 15 minutes in, they're in the panic room. And the whole time, you feel like you're in a panic room. And that's what Fincher's best at, is thrills and tension and, you know, gripping you with the visual style and just his filmmaking technique. You know, that's all this movie is just fundamentals. It is him just, like, running layup lines. So I like Panic Room upon rewatch. Again, it's kind of dated in like its early 2000s-ness. Jared Leto really goes for it. Mm-hmm. But I think it really maybe is a bit of a forgotten hit of his. Like, I really enjoy it. I think it's a great kind of like, if someone hasn't seen it in a while, just be like, check it out again. It's no frills. It is simply what it is. And it's kind of just like unfiltered Fincher, which I like, you know.
Compared to the rest of his movies, and especially his movies of his that I like the most, this is kind of like a rote exercise. Pretty much a single location in this house. I don't think they leave. Do they ever leave the house?
Peripheries of the house, and then at the end, but it's about it.
I think it's like a technical, like a very technically impressive exercise in like geography.
Yes.
And problem solving. And being pretty much right in like intellectual lockstep with the hunters and the hunted, to where you can kind of suspect what they're going to do, but not in a way that feels predictable. like, this just might be what I would do if I was in that situation. And then they, either the robbers or Jodie Foster kind of does that, thing. And that's always nice. But this is on the low end for me, just because it doesn't have a deeper connection or a deeper level of meaning.
Yeah, this I would say what you're just saying about, like, it's like Fincher has this interesting kind of running motif throughout his movies of, like, cat and mouse. Like, he's really interested, sure, in that. And Panic Room is his approach at it of what you're saying, like, single location in real time. And as we'll see, as we talk about these other movies, I'll point out, like, the way he does it, he takes that same idea and kind of does it through a bunch of different lenses is an interesting, you know, within the canon of Fincher, it's always interesting to me. But yeah, this is one I'd recommend to rewatch, because especially on like a, I watched it specifically during one of the presidential debates. Instead of tuning into the presidential debate, I just watched Panic Room.
Fine. Yeah.
But yeah, just, you know, just to like ease my nerves.
Sure.
And so I think it is, but it is like a good kind of stress ball movie where, like, if you are stressed, just like turn out all the lights and watch Panic Room, and it will, it's that strange type of comforting. It matches your stress level, you know?
Yeah. Pierce is a teacher, not a therapist. That's, well, I guess you would call that like, not aversion therapy, but whatever the opposite would be.
Right. Immersion. Yeah.
Immersion. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. My number six is Mank. Still stewing. It was just an experience of like a dawning realization of what this movie was going to be.
Yeah, I don't have much more to say about it. My one recommendation I do make, John, watch Citizen Kane. and here's my recommendation.
All right, let me get a pen.
I recommend to anybody, not just you, but I'd recommend to anybody. Don't make it homework. Just watch the movie as a movie, and I think more people would appreciate it. It would dispel it of this kind of stingy film history, film nerd stink it may have on it from being, you know, at the top of whatever lists for however many years. But watch it. It's a good movie, and I think it would make rewatching Mank much more interesting. I would have to say, but. You know, no rush on rewatching Mank, honestly. I watched it twice consecutive days, and I'm good for a while, you know?
Yeah. I mean, as far as Citizen Kane, like, compared to other movies from the 30s, like, I feel like it would be much more difficult for a lot of reasons to watch something like Gone with the Wind as opposed to Citizen Kane.
Yes.
And I would extend that into the 40s as well. Like, I've seen a handful. It's not a big number, but I've seen, like, maybe a dozen, truly, like a dozen movies from the 40s in general. And like, Double Indemnity is really good.
Yeah.
And that movie too is like really ahead of its time.
Yes.
So maybe
there's a modernity to Citizen Kane that I think it's overlooked. Like, it's what you say. It's ahead of its time.
Pierce, number five.
So number five, this is
where we haven't mentioned any of these movies in the top five yet.
Right. So I guess we have the same top five. So
we do.
What the order is. Okay. But that's good. I do think these maybe are the five Fincher films you meet in heaven or whatever, you know, like
It would be hard to imagine someone having a different top five.
Yes.
I don't know what you would like. Little idiosyncrasy that pushes Panic Room or maybe The Game into the top five. But I can't imagine anyone saying like Benjamin Button or Dragon Tattoo was in their top five Fincher movies.
Right. Well, my number five, much to Shane's dismay, if he's listening this far into the pod, is Gone Girl.
Okay. My number five is Zodiac.
We'll talk about that one later.
Number four.
So at four, I've got Seven.
Okay. My number four is Gone Girl. And, I mean, the barometer on this movie is just like, what's your reaction at the very end when the FBI or whoever drops Amy Dunn at Nick Dunn's house? Just covered in blood. If your reaction is like a cackle or like a, I can't believe they're doing this in this movie in a good way, then yeah, you just have to get on this movie's wavelength. Like, it's campy and it's extremely over the top in a way that I didn't necessarily appreciate when I first watched it. I probably like read a lot of contemporary like gender politics into it at the time, like thinking that, boy, Amy Dunn really should frame Nick Dunn for murder. He was playing video games after she came home from work one day, and he gets what's coming to him. Even still, I'm a tiny little bit sympathetic to her just general sociopathy. But on a second watch, it's so much fun. Even once you know what the twist is, twists plural, of course it's well made, of course it's well scored. I think this is the third Fincher, Trent Reznor collaboration at this point. Probably the best thing Ben Affleck's ever done. It was a huge hit. There's a lot to be said for big, big chunks of the movie, like outlasting the movie itself. It's a blast.
Yeah, Fincher's take on camp is really fun, is what you're saying. Yeah, and I agree with that. Like, you know, it's what I would consider, like, for a lot of the movies we've talked about, like the Fincher bump. It's just, you know, Fincher taking on a subject matter or a genre even, or like a subgenre with this. Like, you know, he essentially takes, I don't know, what is like a airport novel crime story. I don't know what, well, I don't know, you know what I'm saying though? That
oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, mass paperback. And he's just executing it on what I think is just like a really high level. A high level where, as you said, like that has a subtext to it, which is what I like about this movie. This movie's saying a lot about publicity and the media and celebrity and, you know, even gender politics, and applying that to the, you know, modern husband and wife, right? Like there's stuff in this movie that goes beyond just the campiness of the plot. But as you're watching it, the campiness of the plot is quite fun. You know, the Amy Dunn stuff and that performance from Rosamund Pike is the best part of this movie. It's excellent. And,
yeah.
It's a real
shame that she hasn't just been made into a total star.
Right, right. It is bizarre. And Fincher has a couple of those where you're like, he really just picks an actress and then she kind of does her best work, I think, in his movies. But that's a separate conversation maybe. But I do think it's the type of role and performance that will kind of, as years go on, and as years have gone on, it's 6 years since this movie came out. Like, she's not in this echelon exactly, but the type of character you refer to in the same maybe breaths as like a Lecter or something, you know, something like that, where you're just like, oh yeah, if you want to watch like a maniacal sociopath just like enact a master plan, watch Gone Girl, you know? And this was right around when I was really into movies at the end of high school. These types of movies just don't get made. It gets said a lot when a movie that does do something like that gets made, and we overpraise it probably for such things. But like, these high quality directors are not making these big movies that are about very surface level stories, to say the least, you know? And Gone Girl was hugely popular, and for good reason, I think. So I respect it on that level as well, that it's just like a kind of blockbuster movie without any of the frills of a traditional blockbuster, at least in the 2000s, you know. If this movie had come out in the 90s and did massive box office, that would make sense. But in the year 2014, it's an interesting outlier, I think.
Like, it conceivably would have been like the number one movie of the year in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
With no changes, like as aggressively like repulsive and offensive, like forget the arriving at Nick's house covered in blood, like Amy Dunn murdering Neil Patrick Harris and getting covered with that blood seemingly days previous. Again, wild. The cutting of that scene, the editing of that scene, and the scoring of that scene is nightmarish in a way that something like Fatal Attraction is also, but nowhere near as like elegant and right. Horrifying.
Right. Yeah. That's the good. It's not exactly an erotic thriller, which is what a lot of those like 90s Douglas movies kind of get. Yeah. You know, the guy who's too sexy for his own good kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's tangential to that in a way that's, I think, fun. Like, I think it's fun to get that type of movie on that scale with that level of directing. And again, you get like a kind of great cat and mouse game with Amy Dunn's character. Yeah. Yeah. And the Fincher side of it as well is, it's a theme in these last five movies, kind of, and all of his movies, but like, Fincher loves a like psychopathic genius, you know, a meticulous genius. And that's the kind of stand-in for him as a filmmaker, probably, right? And so it's always fun to see the different ways he infiltrates his movies with those ideas. And Gone Girl is probably one of the more fun examples of that.
Number three.
Number three, I have Fight Club.
Okay. My number three is Seven. This is the first of his the first of his movies that was really his after Alien 3, which is kind of amazing that he got to make a movie that on its surface is like anti-commercial as Seven after Alien 3, which, yeah, at best was like a for-hire job. Like, what's the guy who's directing Spider-Man Homecoming doing? I think he's doing another superhero movie next, but, you know, like, stuck in the same. Like, it's not so dissimilar.
It's the inverse. It's the opposite. It's, yeah, usually it's the other way around nowadays.
Yes, yeah. But, like, Seven is just incredibly gory and disturbing serial killer movie that ends as badly as it could possibly go. And it's still, not unlike Gone Girl, a lot of fun to watch. It really understands its characters. It's got great performances from its first four, from its top four actors. And in really inventive in a lot in its gory ways. And certainly not the first like forensic movie at this point. Like Manhunter's been out for a while, but it sure seems like the next step in this kind of like serial killer hunting type of movie. I can't think of another one off the top of my head between Manhunter. Well, Silence of the Lambs was between that.
But this movie feels like a response, or at least in canon with Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, very much in that vein of this like religiously, sexually, spiritually motivated serial killer who's also really good at what he does. I think all of Fincher's movies, with the exception of like Dragon Tattoo, are fun. Even The Game would be a totally acceptable movie to like leave on in the background. Even a movie like Alien 3 that murders a little girl in the opening credits, like I still think those movies are fun, and Seven somehow manages to be fun. Even as really dark as it is.
Mm-hmm. No, Seven for me was like, you know, growing up, once I hit high school, it was probably my, you know, top five favorite movies just in general. Because it's one of those things I think that, and a lot of Fincher, some backlash to him maybe would be that he makes very masculine, sophomoric movies for the kind of teenage film bro. But that's who I was probably. Yeah, and I disagree with that at this point in my life, for sure. But I certainly maybe fit into that perceived trend. That last 30 minutes is, find a better 30 minute stretch in a movie. I dare people to, you know, like it truly, from the second that John Doe turns himself in, which again, talk about showing up with blood on your clothes. started with that trend with Seven.
Very true.
From that moment to the driving out to the desert, to the like, and it's been, you know, whatever, memed or whatever to death, the what's in the box, but even that scene is just, that is a masterclass of filmmaking, editing, tension, acting, like you said, all the main characters, even Kevin Spacey with the limited time on screen he has, all of it is just phenomenal. So where my drawback really is not that I'm like grossed out by it as much as I'm just less amused by the like, look how gross this crime scene is kind of stuff, you know, like rewatching it, the like the knife dildo, I was
sure,
like,
sure, yeah,
hey, this is kind of it again, kind of 90s-ish. And I think there's another Fincher film that I like better than this one that I think tackles some of these serial killer elements more interestingly to me. So like, that's a bit of the drawback, but again, like it's a great watch. It's another one where it's like, it's not exactly rewatchable just because of, I don't know, the content, but it's that thing of like, oh yeah, if you haven't watched this in 5 years, like put it on one afternoon and you will just have a good time.
Yes.
Yeah,
strangely enough, knife dildo several sentences later, good time. Yeah. I only saw this movie probably until I was in college. I only saw the network edit version of it. So that scene was always heavily implied, but not explicit as to what is actually happening. And like, the your imagination is just as powerful as whatever it's showing you in the movie. So it doesn't necessarily make it more appropriate for commercials, for commercial TV. And then yeah, eventually you see the uncut version, and it's like, yeah, great, okay. That's kind of exactly what I was thinking. Your number two.
So my number two is The Social Network.
Okay, my number two is also The Social Network. Okay. We very recently talked about this on the Media Community Club podcast. A slight downgrade. Well, we're at number one and number two. But I did knock this from an A+ to an A because of the scene where Eduardo Saverin's girlfriend lights a scarf on fire. Like, she just turns into a psychopath. It's fine for these characters to not understand and or hate women. But, like, that's the movie, like, crossing over into kind of this. You're justifying their blinkered status with a scene like that. Mm-hmm. And that one scene accepted, like we said it all a few weeks ago. It's one of the best movies of the 2010s. And if you had said this was your number one, that wouldn't even raise an eyebrow.
Yes. And I'll say, if I was pushed, this might be my number one. But I think within the confines of this list, my favorite Fincher movie is my number one. I think Social Network is an excellent movie. But I think because, and this is really just playing semantics, you know, I admit, mm-hmm. but like, because I think so much of the appeal of it as well does come from the Sorkin script, that I look at the other movie as a more Fincher film, and therefore I love it more as a Fincher film than I love Social Network. But Social Network, yeah, we talked about it, but it is in the upper echelon of just movies I enjoy. And on a serious level, I enjoy it. On a superfluous level, I enjoy it. It's what, you know, fun movies are. It's dramatic, but it's not over serious. It's funny, but it's not a comedy. It's just very good.
Yeah, I wrote a very, very long review, and I want to say October or September, at MunichMovie.club, and you can read my many, many, many thoughts there, because I vomited them all over the website. Your number one?
So my number one is Zodiac.
Okay, before you get into it, there's what I consider to be like cool kid versions of number ones from directors. Like with Coen Brothers, it's Miller's Crossing. Mm-hmm. With Tarantino, it's Jackie Brown.
Yes.
And with Fincher, it's Zodiac. Right.
I'll say my love for Zodiac is genuine. I know that's a trend, but I think rightfully so. So this is the thing with Zodiac. It breaks a lot of barriers for me, or not just for me, but I think in general, where it has become a movie that I maybe on first watch found, you know, a bit confounding to be, you know, it's long, doesn't really have a main character, or jumps around. It doesn't really follow your typical movie plot structure exactly. But it's the type of movie that upon every rewatch, I love more and more. And at this point now, I've seen it more times than I should see a movie of its length, just for like the things I also have to do in my life. I've spent too much time probably watching the film Zodiac. But I think it's a very perfectly layered text about kind of it has a very, I think, deep theme to it that it layers perfectly, which is this idea of like our inability to kind of understand like the incomprehensible or like the empirical, right? And it takes it from these many different angles and it weaves it in this, you know, sprawling tale told in this time period in the city and this event with the Zodiac Killer. And I just think it just fucking delivers. And I understand if anyone doesn't like the movie, but I think it gets an unfair shake. I'm curious what your hesitancy towards it is.
You mentioned that on rewatches, this movie improved for you. An equivalent movie for me would be something like In the Mood for Love, mm-hmm. which when I first saw that, I was like, okay, a little dry. And then the second time I watched it, I was like, I'm clicking into this movie. And then the third time I watched it, I was like, all right, this is a fucking masterpiece. And this is an A+, and this is one of the best movies ever made. I didn't see Zodiac in theaters, but when I first watched it, I was like, this is really long. And I expected, after like bathing in Zodiac is a secret masterpiece that deserves to be spoken of in the same breath as the other movies that came out with it in 2007, like There'll All Be Blood, mm-hmm. and No Country for Old Men, and et cetera, et cetera. I expected to like it a lot more on the second and the third viewing, and I just didn't. I think it understands past a certain point that what its main character is doing is stupid and pointless. And it becomes pretty difficult in that last hour to connect with him.
Mm.
Especially once who I think the best actor in the movie, Robert Downey Jr., with the exception of John Carroll Lynch, who was giving him a run for his money. Once Robert Downey Jr. leaves the movie, pretty much all the life goes out of this movie.
Mm.
And it is Jake Gyllenhaal's like sad obsession with something that the movie acknowledges is not important.
Right, but that's, I mean, just because his obsession with solving the Zodiac murders, like, is not important, I don't think that makes the movie unimportant. I think what the movie's showing us about, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, like, human nature through that character of Robert Graysmith, that's important. But I get what you're saying, and I do, like, again, that's what I was saying, I think, where I understand it's not a, like, deconstructed narrative by any means, you know? It's not, like, one of those movies. But it doesn't abide, maybe, by your classic, like, screenwriting tropes.
Definitely not. If Seven is a big swing, then certainly Zodiac is as well. Like,
right.
Fincher, and this is often the case, like, he's just not too terribly interested in, like, summing up or pat endings. Like, it's more of a it's more ellipsis than period.
Right. But I think that's, I mean, I would argue that as a ending is a better statement for this movie that the movie's trying to make, right? Like, you know, not to get too into the movie itself, and I'm not trying to convince you to like this movie by any means, but
and this is number 5 on my list.
Right, exactly, right. But I think the kind of the line in the movie that I think adds the perfect kind of insight to the ending or where this movie is meant to leave you is the scene where Gyllenhaal and Ruffalo meet at the diner,
mm-hmm.
for Gyllenhaal to give his final pitch. And he does the thing where he says, you know, Arthur Lee Allen, you know, lived 50 yards from where she worked. And Mark Ruffalo's like, how do you know? And he goes, I've walked it. And it's this moment of pure certainty, right? He has committed his life to knowing this thing. And like Mark Ruffalo just has to look him in the face and go, but you still can't know for sure, right? And that, I think, is what the movie wants to leave you with, is this, that we live in a world of uncertainty. And he does that, you know, in the rest of the movie, it's this idea of the end of the good vibes era of the 60s. And this, you know, postmodern kind of world in which existential dread and, you know, distrust of the neighbor, and like all these things that he peppers into the movie, I think all layer together to like a really important, or at least important, but also to me, interesting story, all within the confines of the psychology of a serial killer. And that's kind of decoding and decrypting that we do in trying to understand somebody, right? And so all of those things kind of perfectly melt together in this movie for me, in a movie that it's the type of movie, and this is just for me, again, if someone doesn't watch it and have this reaction, that's fine. But as I rewatch it time and time again, all I think to myself is like, it's one of those movies where I just think to myself, like, fuck any movie that's not this movie. Like, I just get so captivated by it, you know? And I think too, it's ahead of its time talking about serial killers the way we think about them now in the world. Not that it was, you know, not forensically or anything, but just in the fact that it totally predicts our obsession with them in the way our world is set up today. And I know this was a thing maybe before the 2000s even, but like watching it today, it feels like Robert Graysmith is the exact archetype of anybody that listens to true crime podcasts or whatever.
Yeah.
The movie.
Some of that might be my disconnect, is that I truly have zero interest in anything true crime.
I do too. I don't listen to those, but I think with the movies, it's less interested in the serial killer then it's more interested in our interest with serial killers. And that I do find interesting, right? It's not...
I don't find that complicated. I find that just really straightforward.
But so then... Again, I don't disagree, I guess.
And yeah, that's just me not connecting to the what is the last hour of the movie. Like, as stuff is happening in the movie, let's say that stuff doesn't happen, and it's not that I need, like, a lot of plot momentum to hook into a movie, but when stuff is happening in Zodiac, when the letters are coming in, when they're doing the news conferences, and they're setting their traps and whatever, that stuff is all great. And when the Zodiac... When the Zodiac Killer is killing people, like, those set pieces are amazing. It's in the Graysmith stuff that, I mean, it's totally fair that you're making these connections, these, like, thematic connections in that period. But for me, I feel like I've made those connections in other areas before I saw Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
So Zodiac becomes just a reiteration of something that is very important for people to understand, like being able to live with uncertainty and the other kind of themes that you mentioned. But that is such an elemental little nugget of adulthood and truth that you only need to really hear it the one time and be convinced of it the one time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I should say too, because this, you're reminding me now that, like, I've gone on and on about kind of that specific angle on this movie, but I also, like you said, I think there are just multiple, like, terrific set piece kind of crime drama, serial killer drama scenes, you know, and he does them. What I think is, like, one of the technically best scenes of the movie is the broad daylight murder by the lake, which is just like,
that's probably the scariest thing.
Yes, exactly.
Fincher's ever done.
Yes. The way he plays with just terror in that way is, you know, amazing. Unfortunately, you know, it's unfortunate that this man is so excellent at conveying terror through a camera, but he does. And then, like, but there's other moments like that that just really, like, rattle my bones. Kind of, you know, when Jake Gyllenhaal goes into the basement, that's just like a Hitchcock level, like, setup knockdown. You know, you can see it in his face the second he makes the realization that he might be face to face with the Zodiac Killer. Is just such a perfect turn, and it's such a dreadful, slow dive into the basement, you know, metaphorically and literally. But it's there's so many different scenes like that that just are like, this guy knows how to make a movie.
I can easily imagine this, like, totally being all in with Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
It's that thematic connection that I just can't hook into. Is what separates it from being, like, this technical, if perhaps a little overlong, but this, like, technical extravaganza, as opposed to something that is, like, affecting and meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the difference between, and for me, that's, like, the difference between a B+ and an A. Like, the A needs that extra oomph, and for me, just Zodiac doesn't make it there. But what does have that extra thematic oomph in spades is Fight Club, which marks me as a specific kind of bro. If Pierce is the cool kid, then I'm the douche bro.
yeah, or just the anarchist, you know. You're the anti-establishment, you know.
Sure. The Uber Letterboxd review is this reviewer giving a series of times that they watched Fight Club. Like, first viewing, this movie is anarcho-capitalist, whatever, that could only exist in 1999. Second viewing, this movie is about a love story between two men or something to that effect. Or third viewing, this movie is a deconstruction of cult mentality. Fourth viewing, whatever. Fifth viewing, whatever. You can just... There are correct readings of Fight Club, and there are incorrect readings of Fight Club. And that a movie can have so many different ways that it can be interpreted is, on its face, impressive. And then when you get to, finally, what is the correct way to interpret it, which is just this very specific pitch and confirmation to me specifically of what it is to be a skeptical person and a good citizen, makes Fight Club one of my favorite movies of all time. This is probably in my all-time top 10. I totally understand that a poster of Tyler Durden adorned the college walls of every person who, if I ran into them now, I would totally despise and hate. But they were wrong. They weren't thinking hard enough about this movie. It's all there. This movie is just, it's the perfect encapsulation of a lot of how I view the world.
Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate that the first thing that I feel the need to talk about with this movie is that I think it's one of the foremost, like, the fans of this movie are worse than the movie type of movies. There's a couple of those out there, you know?
Sure.
And, so that's, like, an unfortunate fact of this movie. And it's the type of thing where, you know, I don't think you blame the filmmaker or the film for that. I think you...
No, it's all in the movie.
Yes, exactly. And so, like, to those people, like, their takeaways from it are valid. I think there are better takeaways to get from it. But I agree with you. You know, it's my number three, and it's, like, behind two movies that I think are just, like, excellent. And I think Fight Club is great. It's a movie that I think works as a whole a lot better than maybe most of the... You know, the reason why I made it to three on my list is for that reason, I think. It's that it's a whole movie that has a lot to it in a good way. There's a level of popularity and iconography around this movie that is so, again, kind of memeable. You know, we've all made the jokes about the first rule of Fight Club, or maybe you've seen someone at a Halloween party, like, dressed as a bad Tyler Durden, you know? But around that, when you rewatch it, you forget how much is in there that is all very interesting and very good. You know, you can just watch the movie and think about the narration and the running, you know, motif of, like, I am Jack's raging bile doctor. You know, you can take one element of this movie each time you watch it and really think about it beyond the very simple anarchist masculine themes. Like, there's more to this movie than that. But it's unfortunate that it gets parodied down to its kind of lowest common denominator. But even then, it's still a very good movie. You know, if you solely take it at that value, you know, like I said, there's a reason why it's the dorm room favorite. You know, when I was in high school, this was another one. I remember exactly what age and where I was when I watched it.
Mm-hmm. So do I.
Exactly. And ever since then, it's the type of movie that just, like, I don't know, for me, got me into movies to a degree for good and bad reasons. You know, it is so specifically wrapped up in exactly what it is, if that makes any sense. And it's this thing that when you think about how popular this movie is, and then what actually happens in this movie, it's so bizarre, you know, to think about certain scenes of this movie, and then you think about how many people can quote this movie. It's a really just, I don't know if there's another movie off the top of my head I can think of that operates on such separate sides of a spectrum, you know. But so I'm always fascinated by it. And I, like you, I don't know if I share its worldview exactly, but I'm fascinated in unwrapping it by watching this movie. So I'm Fight Club, the way it ties together masculinity, violence, capitalism, all of these things, at times can feel college dorm room-y, but as a film, it operates on such a higher level than that.
It's not dissimilar from another 1999 movie, The Matrix, which, you know, has been totally, like, the vocabulary of The Matrix has been totally consumed by the alt-right, when The Matrix is especially now that its directors have come out as trans women, that it's almost explicitly like a trans allegory.
Yes.
And Fight Club is not dissimilar. Like, the scene in Fight Club of Ed Norton and Brad Pitt, like, scoffing at a model advertisement. And then shortly after, or shortly before, I can't remember exactly, but, like, you have Brad Pitt in the almost the exact same pose as the model himself in the ad. And this, it is just operating on so many levels. And it's ultimately, for me, about just, like, the poisonous nature of advertising and manufactured consent. And when you lose the power of choice, and when you've just totally given your mind over to rote patterns, it's just pitched again specifically to me, and I haven't read the book. I can't speak to how much of that is Fincher versus how much of that is however you say that guy's name, sure. Palahniuk, I want to say.
Palahniuk.
Sure. Sounds great. And coupled with like the trippiness of it and how gonzo a lot of it is, as you watch more and more movies, just you find that I need movies to get weirder and swing harder to really distinguish themselves from the pack. And Fight Club swings very hard and really separates itself, even like 21 years ago, and it's just always had this rebellious streak down to its DVD insert that included like negative reviews of the movie. Not just negative reviews, like this movie is dangerous, do the right thing kind of reviews.
Yeah, it operates. I think even in the movie, he turns to the camera at one point and, you know, says whatever the line is, I'd like to thank the Academy. Something along those lines, right? It's operating on that meta level of, again, anti-establishment, you know, which is, again, if you want to draw...
Which is itself a message being sold to you by a major corporation.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And if you want to draw some through lines, like we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, Mank is a movie about someone working within a studio system and ultimately trying to disrupt it in some way, you know? So, to get back to what you're saying, though, I think rewatching it too, the thing that stands out and maybe it's overlooked is, and we haven't spoken a lot about, but like Fincher's visual style, it's such a weird thing to think about, but like how consistently all of his movies are dark and grotesque and gritty. Mm-hmm. And like you watch Fight Club and he really constructs a world of that, but a world of that that feels recognizable in the way you're speaking of, which is that like, It's supposed to be this portrayal of the real world, this real world we live in that we are like, you know, enslaved to based on the, you know, stance of the movie. But he does it also in contrast with this like everything looks like a sewer and all the lighting and the stark cutting of everything. Like there's something, it perfectly, Fight Club is one of the movies that I think you could say perfectly stands as one of the premier texts of how Fincher embodies the meaning of his movie, both in visual style and the story itself. And so I always appreciate that with Fight Club.
And it also exists as a historical document in the same way that recent MMC pick The Beach does. Like these movies just couldn't exist pre 9/11, pre financial collapse. Where like the line in Fight Club is, we have no great war, we have no great depression, our great depression is our lives, our great war is whatever. Well, you know, just give it a few years, and if you want to prove yourself as a man, you'll have plenty of opportunities to do so. And The Beach is not a good movie. Fight Club is just this great representation of this period of time when. That isn't so dissimilar from today, just for a lot of reasons that I could continue to talk about for like a half an hour to an hour. And it would not have like the cultural reach it had, I think, if it came out in like 2003, because it wouldn't work. It just wouldn't work. But as far as depiction of a very specific kind of man, which is not for me what the movie is actually about, it's about bigger things than just manhood in the late 20th century. Mm-hmm. But as the canvas to like paint this timeless, must understand theme upon, there's no better place to put it than on a guy who's obsessed with the IKEA catalog. Mm-hmm. This is in my top 10 of all time.
I think that's a defendable top 10 choice there. I think when I was speaking earlier about the Fincher-ness of a movie, you know, Fight Club's probably the epicenter. You know, if you had to pick one movie that encapsulates most of what he, again, does stylistically, but also is interested in storytelling-wise, I think Fight Club is what everyone thinks of, maybe. Or at least for an amount of time, maybe now that his career goes longer, who knows. But for that reason, I think it bears a lot of burden for the people that don't like Fincher, for whatever reasons. And but also then, you know, like we were saying, I guess it takes from a lot of baskets as far as what it talks about and then who likes the movie, and, you know, go hand in hand. And so the, you know, constituency of people that support Fight Club, I guess, for, I don't know, that feels like putting in weird terms, but the, you know.
Yeah, I would freely admit that most of those people are wrong.
Right. And like, it's not like liking Fight Club is necessarily like indoctrinating yourself into an ideology. I'm not making that bold of a claim.
I think some people would say that.
Right. Exactly. But I don't know if that's true. You know, who knows? But,
well, no, they're actually wrong. To be indoctrinated into the philosophy of Fight Club would be to totally misread what it is about, which is to not let yourself be indoctrinated into a philosophy.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Don't turn yourself into a space monkey by watching a movie about space monkeys. And yeah, if you didn't get that from the movie, then you're just wrong. You're not watching movies correctly. And there's a thing to be said for you.
Yeah.
That's our ranking of David Fincher's work. This was fun. We'll probably do this again for another director. Maybe we'll do Spielberg next and go for like a 3-hour podcast. Someone with a real nice, really lengthy filmography. Check us out on the internet at MunichMovie.club. Like us on Facebook at MunichMovieClub. Follow us on Twitter at MunichMovieCle. I'm John_Kissel at Letterboxd. And Pierce, you are?
So you know what? I think I've been plugging myself wrong for weeks now. Oh dear. My Letterboxd is PB Movies. Just the letters PB. Oh. Movies. And yeah, I put up a review of Tenet, which I did not like. So if anyone's listening, y'all should go read that. And I'll probably be putting out a couple more in the next 2 weeks, hopefully, as I'm off of work.
Thank you for joining me tonight, Pierce.
Yeah, it was great. I was looking forward to this. And definitely we'll do another filmmaker soon.
Absolutely. Have a good night.